Hi, I'm Dick Daso, the Executive Director for the Air Force Historical Foundation. For the past 2 years, we've hosted book club and war stories events. The book club, hosted by Pepe Soto and his technical team, examined individuals and events, from Jimmy Doolittle and Hap Arnold to events of the Vietnam War. War Stories, hosted by Matt Jolly, focused on the American exit from Vietnam some 50 years ago. The Foundation is pleased to announce that it will release these interviews as podcasts through the rest of 2024. We hope that you enjoy the breadth and depth of coverage, and stay tuned for more from the AFHF. Enjoy this episode. Like, subscribe, and pass the links along to your cohort.
Good evening, Pepe Soto here for our sixth and final session this year on Noted Airmen and Aviation Heroes. And tonight's book is by Dick Daso. It's on Hap Arnold. This incredible book. I enjoyed reading it the last few weeks, and we're honored to have with us tonight not only Dick Daso, the author, but also Robert Arnold, Hap Arnold's grandson. But first, I have to open up with some comments from the Air Force Historical Foundation from Ms. John Doolittle. Boo, over to you.
First of all, I want to thank everybody for joining us, our last book club of the year. So I have a special thanks to Pepe, who is conducting this from a hotel room on TDY, and also to his entire crew. They've been great. We've got a lot of things coming up next year. Wanted to briefly touch on what they are. Our focus is going to be on the 50th anniversary of the end of the war in Vietnam. We're doing three things with that in particular. Our book club is going to focus on Vietnam. We are also going to hold a series of war stories that will alternate with the book club. And then the finale for the Vietnam focus will be the symposium that we'll be holding in Denver. So stay tuned and kind of watch what's coming up. Thank you guys for joining us, and I will turn this over to the crew. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonna. First of all, I'd like to welcome Dick Daso. Dick, you have any opening comments for tonight's session?
Not really. I'd just like to say that this is a great topic, and the more we get into it, I think the more we recognize that Hap Arnold could be a general today, and he'd make as much of an impact as he did at the end of World War II. So we'll get on with it, and we'll answer some questions after Robert says hi to everybody.
Robert, welcome to the program, Robert.
Hey. Thanks again for the opportunity to share a little bit about my grandfather's amazing life. It's a privilege to be here with all of you, and I'm looking forward to telling a few stories and bringing a little bit of light on the subject.
Awesome. Okay, so I have questions. Dick, for you, the author of the book. You know, I read the book and I looked for more research on the book, and I'm kind of fascinated that, why don't we know more about Hap Arnold? Outside of your book, no one else did a deep dive on the man. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, he died relatively quickly after the war in 1950. So he didn't have a follow-on life like a lot of the senior generals did. And that's one of the reasons. The other one is, when you start to research all of the things you need to tell the story of this man, it's volumes and volumes and volumes of papers and other documents. In the modern world, printing books that are more than 400 pages just doesn't happen anymore. And so what ends up happening, and what's happened with Hap Arnold, is, for example, this book is a techno history. And what you'll find is it focuses on that aspect of not only his life, but how that influenced the development of our Air Force. But there's a really great, there's a couple of books out there on the Pacific Theater. One is by the late Herm Wouk called Cataclysm, which is all about the war in the Pacific. There's another one on the Pacific. There's the diaries of Hap Arnold's travels throughout Europe during World War II that was edited together with commentary by a former director of Air Force History, General Houston. And it's massive. You can get it on for free on the Air University Press webpage. So it's more in chunks, largely because studying Hap Arnold is a lifelong event. The other part of it is that his papers, unlike Marshall, Eisenhower, and others, have not been published into volumes and volumes of printed and electronically available works. That's one of the things that the foundation is starting to do with our association with the University of Alabama.
Robert, what do you think? Any comments from you, sir?
Part of the problem, as Dick mentioned, is he dies pretty young. He's only 64 when he passes away. Very young man by today's standards. The other problem is that, you know, just about the time he dies, the Air Force becomes a separate service and is in search of its own modern roots. That's part of it, too. The other thing is that despite all of his accomplishments, which we're going to talk a little bit about today, he was a pretty personally modest man. So he saw himself as the front for this enterprise, this thing he would say, this thing called air power. But he was much more interested in World War II in particular, of putting other people out in front. His old friend Tui Spots, for example, Jimmy Doolittle, and some of the newer folks that came along that he meets during the war, Curtis LeMay is one of them, but there are others. He is more interested in making them the face of this new thing called air power going forward, because he knows his time is limited at this point.
Next question. The book discusses his relationship with many of the pioneers of aviation, especially the Wright brothers. How important are these relationships to Hap building the Air Force needed for World War II? Dick?
Well, I mean, essentially, Arnold, his whole life traces the evolution of the early airplanes. So being introduced to the Wright brothers and going through their school in Dayton was the establishment of the knowledge he had on aviation. It's interesting to know, though, that Hap Arnold never flew with either one of the Wright brothers. He went to ground school with them, but he never flew with either one. A guy named Al Welch, or Owl, they called him. Al Welch was his instructor pilot. So he was at the basement level with the development of aviation, from how to put an airplane together, all the maintenance, he did the first deployment, how to take it apart, put in a railroad car. So from the very beginning, he was learning everything that would grow and grow and grow into what eventually became operations during World War II. And I think that's what he got out of that experience. I'm sure.
Robert,
The experience with the Wrights in Dayton in 1911 is really key, because he had had a couple of experiences with flying before that. He'd watched Frank Lamb take a balloon off from West Point. That didn't overly impress him. He had seen Blériot's plane that had crossed the English Channel on the streets of Paris as a young man, and had a vision of many planes flying over an ocean barrier, but was not impressed by the hardware he saw. But then he gets to the Wrights, and he spends a lot of time with them. Not only the flying school part, but he's actually taking meals at the house with the family. And the Wrights are a family who argues things back and forth in a positive way. And they're talking about everything. And all of a sudden he realizes he's seeing it all. He's seeing production, research and development, legal, weather forecasting, training, all these things going on in these conversations. And he's seeing the entire thing of aircraft production and development on a very small scale right in front of him. And he's noticing it's all about incremental improvements, that whatever machine he sees is not tomorrow's machine, that this is going to continue on and on. And also on top of that, that these are nice Midwestern middle-class people. These are not geniuses from an ivory tower in Heidelberg, Germany. These are normal American go-getter, hardworking people with a vision and knowing to do things, people like himself, which means that a lot of people can make this enterprise go. You just didn't need to have Leonardo da Vinci sitting there to make it happen. So this, all of a sudden, the practical side of him says, hey, this is going places. So the vision is now important, not necessarily the hardware of the moment.
Yeah, and a good book, that's great comments, because the Wright brothers are misunderstood by a lot of historians, but Dave McCullough's book on the Wright brothers goes into detail about how they basically developed aerospace engineering on their own, taking all the models apart and making doing their own test beds, their own engines, their own, you know, experiments to figure things out. So you said your grandfather was there watching that process take place, because that must have been just fascinated to be there at that time.
Right.
That's a really interesting point, too, because at this point in American history, they're going to combine two different kinds of science and engineering, the German school or the experimental school with the practical school, which is something more like what's going on in the United States. Senator Susan Collins.
Robert, you had a question? Do you have something to talk about also?
No, I was just going to say, Dick's right on it. I mean, these Midwesterners are just impressed as the hell out of them. Dayton, Ohio's an interesting place for Hap Arnold, too, because the rice introduced him to other people. And that little town there at one point has more patents per capita than any other city in the United States. There's a lot of these little folks there, a lot of them who become important in the whole story of the rise of aviation because of his relationship with the Wright brothers and the time he spends in Dayton.
It's amazing. Robert, real quick, Dick, I was just surprised reading your book that Hap was not an ideal cadet at West Point. It was also for the cavalry assignment he wanted, pretty much due to his attitude. How does his evolution from his days as a cadet at West Point to one of the founding fathers of the Air Force take place? Because he didn't seem to have he was motivated, but didn't seem to play by all the rules at West Point you're supposed to play by, and seemed to have be pretty much going against the system, yet he ended up developing the system, which today's modern day Air Force.
It's a great story, and for all Academy grads and West Pointers, you're right. He was not an academic. There's no doubt about that. And while he was militarily at the top third of the class most of his time, remember there's only 111 graduates in the class of 07. He gains his leadership skills from a completely different angle. He's constantly in trouble officially because he's the leader of what's called the Black Hand, which is the pranksters for their class. And so he's like the president of the Spirit Missions guys. So they take and move the Reveille cannon up to the top of the dormitories, and they roll cannonballs down these wooden steps in the middle of the night to wake everybody up. He in particular did in their senior year, which is why he marched tours the last 3 months of his cadet career and missed his senior dance because he was on restrictions. They lit up a fireworks display that on the academic building that 1907, never again, which was their class motto. And attack officers put him in prison for that infraction. But that was a different kind of leadership. It took leadership to get this band of pranksters together in the middle of the night and not get caught getting out of their rooms and accomplish these tasks and other things. So yeah, it was he wasn't straightforward. He's no George Marshall, that's for sure. But he learns leadership to get around the rules. And I think one of the things, especially in working on a new technology, was to figure out ways to get around some of the embedded old school rules. And I think a lot of people who have gone through a military type environment understand that there are lots of different ways to be a leader in a military environment. I think he learned that there. And I think Spots actually said it best, and it applied to a lot of the younger airmen. He said, from the beginning, we've been a different breed of cat. And so you have some of the leaders that went up the chain in the air service into the air forces who did things differently than the old army. You got to remember, one of Arnold's professors at West Point fought in the Civil War. So it's a completely different environment that he grew up in at that point in time that we can't frankly understand that today.
Robert, thoughts about from you?
Yeah, I think right on what Dick said, the sense of humor runs strong. I mean, I know in my family, my dad and his brothers had a rough sense of humor and practical jokes, and that came directly from Hap. The story I like to tell, and my dad liked to tell, was about the Barling bomber, which when Hap is at what is now Wright-Patterson in 1929, there's still this thing, this 1922 World War I design bomber that they've got. It's huge. It won't even fly. They haven't flown in 5 years, but it cost something like $1 million when the government had it built, and it's there. And the government won't allow it to be destroyed. And they also won't fund any other bombers because they say, you already have one of these. Why do you need any more? And they completely annoyed the hell out of Hap Arnold. He kept asking them, could he have this, this scrapped and move on? But it became what he saw was this kind of heavy weight on the back of the air services. So Pop told the story. There was one Saturday afternoon at lunchtime at the quarters, and Hap Arnold looks at his watch and says, it's 12:25. In 5 minutes, there's going to be a fire. And the kids all look at him and say, what are you talking about? What's going to burn? And he ignores them and keeps eating his lunch. And 5 minutes later, there's all these sirens of the trucks going by and all this sort of thing going down the road. They walk over to the window and look out and across the field. There's this little bit of smoke coming up on the other side of the field. And he says, you know, that looks kind of like a hangar. At which point the phone rings and he said, yep, that's what it is. Puts it down. Yep, apparently the hangar's on fire. Well, how do you know that? Well, you know, I could kind of see it coming. So what it was the hangar with a Barling bomber in it. So he sits there. So at the end of this whole thing, before the lunch is over, the phone rings and it's the officer of the day wanting to know how to record the fire. So he says to them, well, make sure you use the tail number of the airplane and don't call it the Barling bomber because that isn't the official name. So that's the report that goes into Washington. The tail number was destroyed in a fire, but they never officially said it was the Barling bomber. So he got away with it, but he got rid of this thing that he saw was a technical, you know, iceberg hanging over the air service that they couldn't afford. This is a typical getting around at Hap Arnold with just a little bit of that prankster and practical joker on him as well.
Wow.
Well, and that story was confirmed by a colleague of mine in the Smithsonian. He lived there in Dayton at the time with his family, and his father had confirmed that he walked through the hangar that had burned to the ground. He didn't see the Barling specifically, but that incident actually did take place.
All right, try that one today.
you're gone. Hey, Mel, we have some questions in the field.
Hey, I'll go ahead and cue those. Oh, sorry. I'll go ahead and cue those up, the first two for you. So we have Paul first. He's ready with his question.
Yes, there's an old saying that not all readers are leaders, but all leaders are. But all leaders are readers. Was Hap Arnold a big reader, especially of military history?
Well, I can tell you this is that because I ended up with a lot of it. My grandparents had a huge library, and we're talking also. They read all these classics, the kind of books that don't even get close to being on the. On the chief's lips today. We're talking all the French writers and old English writers and stuff like that, hugely widely read. Yes, and I'm talking box after box of the old professional books that ended up at the retirement house. So they had a lot of my dad had huge amounts of books, and for God's sakes, I got box after box, and bookcase after bookcase. So definitely a huge reader.
Now, I will say that during service, particularly after World War I, he was less of a reader because he was too doggone busy.
Yeah, but it was in the house.
Another question out there, Jen?
I got a question.
So actually, we're going to go to Scott Marquise.
Okay. Hi, Dick. Scott Marquise here.
Hi, Scott. How are you, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing well. You're looking... very well, little gray like I am up on top here. And I still think of our training sessions And I still use some of your toolbox analogies. So, but maybe one or two questions. You can pick the one you want. I always ask this of a biographer. And that is, if you've done jobs of research. And there's got to be something in this research that you say, why the hell did this man do this? And you've never been able to find the answer. That's what I want. That's like a head scratcher. Why? That kind of thing. Why did he do this? I can't tell why. That kind of thing.
How about if I answer this? There's a, for everybody else, Scott is a docent out at the Hazy Center, and that's, we go way back. So it's good to see him again. There is something that I have not been able ever to find that I have looked for and looked for and looked for. During the Alaska flight, Arnold led 10 B-10 bombers up to Fairbanks, Alaska. And while they were there for 2 weeks. And they did photo runs of territories in Alaska because there was no way to get there other than by boat. So now this is the first experiment in taking airplanes to Alaska, but they were there for 2 weeks. And there is somewhere, I've never been able to find the photographs, but there's a kind of a story out there that the reason they stayed there was to photograph the route to Russia, the archipelago. And I've never been able to prove that or prove it wrong. It made sense because Arnold would have thought that way. But that's the answer to that question. I wish I knew that for absolutely for a fact, but I don't.
Thank you.
Do you know, Robert?
No, I don't either, Dick. I've got the pocket diary from the trip, but right. You know, it doesn't talk about that. It talks about all kinds of other stuff, but it does not talk about that at all.
Right.
So either that or somebody took all the pages out, you know what I'm saying?
Somebody did, yeah.
I got a question, if possible.
Go ahead.
Phil.
Hey, Phil.
Hey, I want to go back to West Point real quick and mention the fact that you talked about him marching tours. Remember, he was a clean sleeve, which means he never wore cadet rank as a cadet. And in 4 years as a cadet, that's hard to do. But what is even better is that who takes his place as chief of staff of the Air Force is Tui Spots. Guess what? Tui Spots was a clean sleeve who never had cadet rank and marched tours up until graduation day. And his place was taken by Hoyt Vandenberg. And guess what? He too was a clean sleeve who never wore cadet rank and marched tours up until graduation day. So I think that says something about leadership in the Air Force, but I'm not exactly sure what it says. The thing I did want to ask, though, was what do you think was his influence on the Air Corps Tactical School during the 1930s? Because at the time, he's an operational commander then, he's not in charge, and yet so much stuff is going on theoretically and intellectually at the York Hart Tactical School. Did he have any influence on that? Was he called upon to reflect or to talk about his ideas at the time on strategic air power?
He didn't talk to AC, the guys at the tactical school, hardly at all. I mean, he's given a speech there that I've seen. I think that the Air Corps Tactical School sort of went on its own. And I think overall he supported that. But I also feel that some of the programs he ended up supporting throughout his senior career didn't pay any attention to the Air Corps Tactical School or strategy or doctrine at all. Like the GB-1 through 8 glide bomb series designed specifically to stand off from targets when doctrine at the time was what we called then pickle barrel bombing, where you overflew a target with 100 to 1,000 bombers and you put the bombs from a special bomb site on the target. He didn't care about that so much when airmen were getting shot down and losing their lives over the target. He did have some influence, but I think the actual instruction and the development of the curriculum was largely independent of his influence. That's a really good question too.
I got another question, if I may, and that is, you may be familiar with a gal by the name of Kathy Wilson, who's presently writing a biography of Frank Andrews.
Frank Andrews,
very, yeah. Very important airman, a contemporary, obviously, of Hap Arnold's and whatnot. And she had a devil of a time trying to figure out the connection between those two. So I would ask you, in a broad sense, what was the relationship between Hap Arnold and Frank Andrews? And secondly, the big question was, if Frank Andrews was called back to Washington in 1943, who called him back and for what? I.e., there's a lot of speculation that he was being called back to Washington because he was going to be given a new command. He was a commander of the European Theater at the time, but that was a logistic command. It wasn't a combat command. So what was he being called back to Washington, D.C. for? Was it for an Air Force job? Was it for a joint job? Was it for a combined job or what? Do you have any idea?
I know Kathy's been working on that. We've talked about that very, very event. I think it's speculative as to what the reason was. You know, the rumor that's been spread throughout the years is he was going to lead the invasion. I don't think that was the case. I think that he was going to perhaps be what Tui Spots became during that activity because he of his rank and experience in logistics. But I don't have any hard and fast answer to that. And I certainly can't imagine that Arnold called him back. So I don't know if it would have been maybe McNarney. I'm not sure. I just don't know.
Okay. Well, let me interject here just a sec, is that Andrews has a tight relationship with Marshall as well. It goes on to before the war starts. In the family, the story always was that Andrews was going to have the Eisenhower job in Europe. That was the story within the family. But that's all I can tell you. It's what everybody felt.
Okay. It seems totally, I agree with Dick. That seems totally unlikely. I mean, he had never had an actual combat command up until then. And to put him in charge of Overlord with hundreds of thousands of men from the Brits and the Americans when he had never done anything like that before, just seems kind of fanciful.
Yeah, the one thing I would throw in though is that he was tight with George Marshall.
Yes.
Okay.
He was.
Okay.
So was Eisenhower.
But even more so, I think, and trumps that, I believe. Eisenhower was kind of seen by the rest of them as sort of the young guy, because I remember them talking about the young guy. And I think they would have seen Andrews as slightly more senior. I don't know. I'm just speculating now. But that's just based on the conversations they had when I was young.
I want to take this chance to a great segue about Hap Arnold's relationships, because we talked amongst ourselves about relationships he had with various generals. So kind of a shotgun around for Robert and Dick is, what about his relationship with Tui Spats? How did that start, and how close is that relationship?
Well, he and Spats go all the way back through World War I, but the relationship is that Arnold trusted Spats completely, and Spats was the operational arm of Arnold's administrative arm. I think the real defining time for that relationship was when Eisenhower was putting together his staff for the invasion. He was talking about who would be the air commander there. And this leads into a change of commanders that I think a lot of people misunderstand what it was about. Ira Anker was the commander of the 8th Air Force at the time. He ends up being removed from that command and moved to the Mediterranean to be the commander of a combined force in that region. And for the longest time, people have speculated that he was fired because things weren't going as well as Arnold thought they would. In reality, it's a little more simple than that. Eisenhower was familiar with Spots and wanted him and liked him to be his air commander. At that time, there was a rank structure issue between the Brits and the U.S. And if a British commander left a job and an American commander went in, it had to be a certain rank. And Acre had the third star that the U.S. needed to put in the Mediterranean, and he had all of the qualifications to do the job. And I think it was that simple. It was a practical move because Acre had the rank. There was a hole that had to be filled, and Eisenhower wanted spots. And that really explained how all of those moves worked before the landing. So that's, he trusted spots to do any job. He would give it to him and let it go.
Robert?
Yeah, I agree with what Dick said. The relationship with Tui Spots is almost like it's not a brother relationship, but it's pretty darn close. And that Tui was completely unflappable. If you got a minute, I'll tell you a funny story about that. The two of them are at Chrissy Field in San Francisco and doing all kinds of crazy things with airplanes, particularly biplanes, doing all kinds of stunts to attract attention for the Army Air Service. And it's also... It's prohibition time, and you weren't allowed to have any booze on post. But they're going to have a party at Hap Arnold's place anyway. So they're making drinks in the back of the quarters, and Tui Spots is the bartender. So Hap decides to pull a practical joke. So he goes out front and yells through the front door, "It's a raid." At which point, Tui Spots, without missing a beat, picks up all the bottles and pours them down the drain in the sink. Yeah, so he's not gonna let that happen. Anyway, that's a true story. That's Tui Spots cool under fire. Anyway, they had a wonderful relationship.
Next one is about Jimmy Doolittle. I mean, he actually bested Doolittle when he was a young pilot for being Jimmy Doolittle, you know, flying crazy. Yet when the mission for Tokyo came, things passed that. It seemed he had a incredible trust for Doolittle from both an engineer perspective as well as a tactical perspective. Can you go into that?
Yeah, the story about Cecil B. DeMille and filming Jimmy Doolittle riding on the axle of a biplane, legendary, and Arnold is the executive officer for the Colonel Burwell, I think was his name, yeah, on the post at Rockwell. So Burwell told him to go ground this guy. So he did, went and grounded him for a month or something like that. Introduction to Doolittle, not the most favorable you could have in the Army. But later on, the thing you have to keep in mind from that point on about Arnold's relation with Doolittle is what Doolittle does. He goes off in the mid-20s and gets a master's degree in aeronautics and the first PhD in aeronautics from, what was it, MIT, right, John?
Right.
And so he has the technical skill that Arnold is absolutely in favor of. So combine that different breed of cat kind of calculated risk kind of thing that Jimmy was known for and the technical knowledge that he had. And then in the 30s, he leaves the service and goes to Shell and becomes a vice president for fuels at Shell. And he gets all this experience in industry and what is going to be the development of 100-octane fuel, for example. They don't have it then. It's like 64-octane fuel. But by the time the 30s are over and things are starting to get worse in Europe, Arnold's going to bring him back to be the problem solver, and he will use him in that regard. There's a very, very famous story about him and Paul Tibbetts, A-26, or one of the early, maybe, I don't remember, but I think it was the A-26, but it had a asymmetric thrust problem when an engine went out, and so he took him up flying. Doolittle took Tibbetts up, pulled the engine to idle while they were flying an overhead pattern and showed him how to land this thing that nobody could land, and people were killing themselves in it. And he did it in front of the whole squadron on the flight line. And so Arnold recognized what Doolittle's purpose was, and what Arnold's no angel. he understands that attitude. And of course, who else would you select when you have to execute the raid? It was sort of a no-brainer for Arnold, really. He had to trick a few people up the chain of command to pick him, but it worked out okay in the end.
Robert, any comments from you, Robert?
Well, I was just going to say, this was kind of like, and again, kind of like Hap's younger brother in some ways, because and also one of the go-to guys. One of the stories of Hap Arnold in World War II is he had this little list of go-to guys, some of which are pre-war, Jimmy Doolittle, Tui Spots, Ira Aker, people like that. And then there are also ones he picks up along the way, that would be Johnny Eielson, Flip Corcoran, Paul Tibbetts, later Curtis LeMay, who he barely knows, but who he picks up as these people that he sizes up, understands what they bring to the party, gives them ultimate authority. In the case, sometimes even written pieces of paper, says, Hap Arnold says, do whatever this guy asks you to do, and sends them out and says, make it so, because he trusts them. And he's also picked them because of the skill set they have, what they're going to do. Jimmy Doolittle has a huge amount of skill sets. Once he settles down from being the crazy fighter pilot, which Hap Arnold recognizes, because underneath it all, he's still one of those, although he has put that away. But he reckoned once that settles down and has the MIT degree and experience with Shell and the instrument flying and all these other things, he's bringing to the table the flying skills of what my father said was the best pieces of flying you ever saw, was Jimmy Doolittle on an air show. And probably one of the best pilots that Hap Arnold ever saw. And he brought that to the party along with the modern technical stuff. And you're watching what I call the hinge here, where the Air Corps, Air Force is changing from the World War I scarf and the Red Baron stuff into what we would call the technical age. You're starting to see the marriage of that pilot skill with also technology being embodied pretty much inside Jimmy Doolittle. He's part of that whole change.
That's good. Word hinge. Go ahead, Dick.
I was also going to say that, you know, Doolittle's also the first pilot to fly across the United States in less than 24 hours. Then he's the first pilot to fly across the United States in less than 12 hours. He's an air racer. He breaks all kinds of records. I mean, he is like the epitome of being a pilot when people didn't even know what it was.
Hello, I'm Dick Daso, Executive Director of the Air Force Historical Foundation. We're thrilled to launch our official podcast and hope you're enjoying it. But there's so much more to explore and enjoy as a member of the foundation. Our morning release, This Day in Air and Space History, is available on most social media platforms and your email. The Foundation newsletter, the Raider Chronicles, the Journal of the AFHF, both document Foundation programs and take detailed looks at our service history. The Foundation's Fall Symposium and Museums Conference includes cutting-edge scholarship focusing on aviation and space history topics and amazing examinations of air and space museum exhibits and curation. I'd like to personally invite you to visit our website at afhistory.org and spend some time examining our programs, affiliations, publications, and archives. Once you do, I sincerely hope you'll join us. A basic digital membership is only $30 a year. As a nonprofit organization, AFHF depends on the support of our members, both in dues and donations. If you join before April 1st, you'll receive a copy of our 2023 Summer Special Journal, a full 164 pages focused on the 50-year anniversary of the U.S. exit from Vietnam. You can also watch the proceedings from the 2023 Vietnam Symposium by accessing our research page. Thanks for listening and join us today. Until next time, know the past, shape the future.
And I, of all of the people that Arnold knew, he might have been the most difficult to deal with because, you know, you have rules, but you don't always have to follow them. It was sometimes a do what I say, not as I do kind of thing. It went for Arnold, but Arnold let Doolittle get away with that sometimes too.
Yep. I would also say that, Dick, you've written about Doolittle a lot. And I think what we need to remember about Doolittle is that it's easy to forget when we see what a great pilot he was, a great stick, and a great airman, that he was also a hell of a leader. And so mm-hmm. when it came time to have a combat command, the first one in Europe was actually North Africa. They give him, Arnold gives him command of the 12th Air Force. And then when he goes get ready for the Overlord invasion, he puts Doolittle in charge of the 8th Air Force. And then when they transition the 8th Air Force to B-29s and move them to the Pacific, it is again Doolittle who does that. So to me, it's easy to forget when you look at his racing exploits and his personality, which is larger than life, that he was also one astonishing combat commander. And in fact, Arnold looked to him as the go-to guy throughout the war. Whenever he needed the best man possible in a combat command, it was Jimmy Doolittle.
And there's a great irony in that, Phil, too, because Doolittle's first combat mission was the raid on Tokyo, as it was for almost all of the people who went on that raid. So what came after that is sort of a logical conclusion after that. You're exactly right. He had natural leadership ability.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rob used the word hinge a few minutes ago, and that's essentially a word to use because relationship-wise, he had a relationship as a brigadier general with Theodore Carman, who mm-hmm. I see his name in all these other books. He seems to be this person everyone talks about but only knows about. How important was that relationship with Carman for him to build the Air Force that he was building at the time and for the future?
Well, you should be asking Dick. He wrote the whole thesis about Carman. You got to talk to Dick about that one.
Well, because the Air Force we have today is fundamentally due to the relationship that Arnold cultivated with Theodore von Carman. He had, largely because of his relationship with people outside of the Army, for example, the leadership at Caltech, Robert Millikan, who he met during World War I. Millikan goes on to be the president of Caltech. Arnold loans Millikan bomber aircraft to do experiments with cosmic radiation, and he ends up getting to know the entire faculty at Caltech, including the Hungarian import, Theodore von Karman, who the gas lab and the wind tunnel at Caltech is still named after von Karman today.
Right.
And while Arnold was stationed at March Field, he used to go down there to the wind tunnel and talk to von Karman. And so even in the late 20s and early 30s, that relationship was cultivated. And so when it came time to look ahead into what the future of the Air Forces would be, Marshall told Arnold, okay, the war's almost over. I want you to look forward into what we're going to do next. He went right to von Karman. And von Karman was the one who forms what we now know as the Scientific Advisory Board, which he chaired until 1963 when he died. And then it still goes on today. And it started pretty small. There were only like 33 PhDs then. And so they did a lot of work during World War II. Now, if we talk about, say, the New World Business Study from 1994, there were over 400 scientists involved in that Air Force study. So that is the foundation of the technology and the technological base of our service. That's Arnold's legacy in my mind. That's why I wrote this book, because the leadership part is important. Arnold's an administrator. He is actually and technically the chief of staff. He's not a combat guy. He's a staff officer. And that's something that everybody needs to remember. He never fired a shot in anger ever in his whole career. He tried to, but he never made it into combat. So he is literally the definition of a chief of staff that we have today. They're a little different. All of them have combat experience and that kind of thing. But there's no other service. They all have scientific relationships now, but there's none like the Air Force relationship with science, industry, universities, the aeronautical industry. And it's been that way since Arnold was in charge of things, with Douglas, Larry Bell, all of the big World War II industrialists were first name with Hap. And so that is a legacy that it's very clear when you look back in his life, and things were so small when they started and they expanded to the size that they were, 2.4 million at the end of the war, from 25,000 people in the service when they started. He actually said that growing the force was the thing that killed him in the end. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what's really important about von Karman. And you're right, he doesn't get enough coverage probably because I think he was a lot like Arnold. He was a behind the scenes guy. Karman was a seed sower. He dropped projects in people's laps, then he went off and did more projects in people's laps.
The I want to add in here a little bit is that part of the singular nature of Hap Arnold is this swimming in the sea of technologists that starts with the Wright brothers. That from the get-go, he meets everybody and becomes friends with them. He has a photographic memory for faces and people and facts that they introduce themselves to each other. People start knocking on his door because he's the only guy in the Army that you can sell stuff to. You know, he wrote a letter to his father saying he can't believe everybody's showing up wanting him to buy stuff in 1911, like he can do that. And so there's these people. There's the Donald Douglas relationship that starts in 1917, on and on and on, whether it's General Electric and all these other people. And he knows what everybody's doing and they're talking to him and what's new. He is absolutely comfortable with these people. In fact, Marshall comes to him one time and asks him, what are you doing with all these people? And he says, that's where it's at. You know, these are the people who are going to build the future for me. And I want to be part of that. And I want them to be part of this Air Force. And I think that's what makes him different. If you had had an operator, everybody says, well, you wanted a guy to be chief during the war. It was like a combat operator. Well, a combat operator didn't know how to pick up the phone and tell Donald Douglas he needed another 250 C-47s by D-Day, and he couldn't tell him why. I mean, this is the kind of thing that he was uniquely placed to do. And history wanted him to be there, and here he was.
Awesome. Hey, Jen, over to you and Mel for more questions to field.
Hi, so we'd like to go to Mr. Troy Barnes to ask his question, if you're available to ask your question, sir.
Yep, appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity. I've enjoyed this book for the last 10 plus years, and I'm really curious from you, in what ways would Arnold play a role in today's General Officer Corps? How would he lead? Looking into the future, in some ways, history rhymes, and the Air Force in particular seems to have a revolution of technological advancement. I'm curious how Hap would impact today's General Officer Corps. Thanks.
I think that he would like what he sees, but he would constantly press people to do more, better, and faster.
He's a man in a hurry.
Go ahead, Robert.
Well, I was going to say that he would be thrilled at the educational level of the force. He would be pleased that the enterprise spans so many things because he saw all of that. He would like a lot of it. He'd ask, why the hell are you only designing one bomber? Why are you putting all the eggs in one basket? Things go wrong. Programs go sideways. What are you going to do if you don't have another one? He would be pleased that the B-52 was built so well, but he says, why the hell are you still flying on? He would be saying, you all need to be doing more and you should be doing it faster. And he would do it with a smile. He'd be very pleased with all of this. But he would also be worried about the narrow nature of the technological advancements into small, narrower programs, I'd say. That's pretty basically what I would say.
I think the other part of his philosophy that he carried his entire career was something that he called the balanced air program. He got a lot of flack when he first started in command in the late 30s because the first program he wanted to do to build up the force was to make training airplanes. that when what we need is combat planes. And he politely explained that, well, you can't fly a combat plane without trained pilots. He had a bigger vision for the process by which an airplane became air power. And that leans all over the use of national air forces to create the air force. The title of the book, for example, Air Power, refers to what he would refer to as national power. The word air force to Hap Arnold was the application of airplane power in combat. And that's why the title of the book is what it is, because his influence was not just on military airplanes and power. It was on the national look at what air power is and what it can be used for. That's all I got on that.
Yeah, I think absolutely, Dick. I agree with you 100% on that one.
Hey, Pepe, could we talk about a couple of myths and things that'll only take a minute to clear up?
Sure.
So Hap Arnold won the Best Flight of the Year trophy twice. He won it the first time, and then he won it again for the Alaska flight. But Robert, how do you say the name of that trophy?
Mackey.
Right. It's the Mackey Trophy. So for years, everywhere I went, even at the Smithsonian, people say it's the Mackey Trophy. And so, no. And how do you know that?
Because they knew the family. It's the Mackey family. They're the ones who popped for the trophy.
I know. It's great. Myth one. It's the Mackey Trophy. What else? The other one I wanted to talk about personally, because this comes up time after time. It was just in, again, the Smithsonian published this, an article on Hap Arnold, how he got his flying groove back, but it's wrong. His nickname, Hap Arnold, didn't start being called Hap Arnold until 1931. He had several nicknames in his career. At West Point, he was named after a character in a cartoon in a serial that was published in a newspaper called Pewter Purinton. They called him Pute Arnold. He was, to his mother and his wife, he was Sonny, or Sonny Jim, who was the character for a product that was made up in the North. And he actually drew characters that were related to that showed his funny Grinch-like grin. But the real reason, he didn't get called Hap because he smiled in his 1912 film that he made where he carried the mail somewhere and the director called him Hap. That's just not true. It's a completely different story. In 1931, his mother became sick in January and suddenly died of a heart attack. And it absolutely, totally destroyed him. And it was even worse than when he lost his infant son, John Linton, in the 1920s. He never really recovered from it, and Arnold kept those kind of things buried deep down inside of him. As an author and a researcher, when I was doing this part of the book, my basement had all of his letters taped up along the whole basement wall. My wife never forgave me. And I had been going over the 1920s and 30s for months and months. And one night I woke up in the middle of the night and I knew it. I went downstairs and I looked at the letters, and all of his letters were signed Sonny and Sonny Jim. And then they stopped suddenly in March and April of 1931 after his mom died. And he started signing them Your Hat. And that's the very first time. And from that point on, just to assuage the memory of his mother's death, he changed his name to Hap. And it's one of those tragic, wonderful stories that have been wrong forever. And I've been trying to get this out there ever since the book came out in the early 2000s. So it is Hap, but it's for a completely different reason than people have written about for years and years and years. Mythbuster 2.
And that is a history mystery detective story solved by Dick Daso.
Duke, we have a few more questions from the field real quick before we wrap up. So, Mel, you want to take those?
Absolutely. I'd like to go out to Mr. Joe Bassi. And apologies if I mispronounced your last name there, sir.
No, that's right. Joe Bassi next to Vandenberg Space Force Base. And full disclosure, I was a career space guy who often got lectured on how I was killing my career doing this space stuff. And so I wanted to read a quote that's in a book called The Endless Frontier, a biography of Vannevar Bush, who actually was the head of the Manhattan program. And Robert, great meeting you. It's a great pleasure. The quote is apparently in context with von Karman, that the problem of the Air Force, and this was in 44, pilots, 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 and more pilots. He told von Karman, I see a manless Air Force that is going to be built around scientists. And I wish I had come across this quote earlier in my career. In 1990, I wrote my War College paper on why the Air Force shouldn't be doing space stuff. So I wouldn't put myself in the category of your dad or your grandpa or Ira Aker, but space people are a different breed of cat. And so I was very happy to see developments in the last couple of years.
Well, for another example of that is that Hap Arnold wrote in 1945 that going forward, you know, there were going to be pilotless airplanes, that the future of this whole thing were going to be things that he would start describing, he would understand as missiles and things like that. He saw it. He said he saw all of this in 1945. And part of what he did, he sent Benny Schriever off to do this. You encouraged him to do this. This is a mission that was Benny was sent on by Hap Arnold, and Benny would say that. All the characteristics that people talk about Schriever are very much Hap Arnold characteristics. He was completely clear about that. He would be just fine with all of those things.
By the way, when I was at Air Command and Staff College, I got to travel around as escort with Benny Schriever. And it was one of the highlights of my 26 years on active duty. And he was a very chatty guy.
Yes, he was.
And we drove up to Brett Hall at Maxwell. And he said, Joe, that's my father-in-law. I knew I was with Air Force royalty.
So let me clear something up about Arnold's views on this. And if you go to the report to the chief of staff that was published by it was under Arnold's name. But if you go to that report that went to General Marshall in both 1943 and 1945, it is an exact copy of Karman's report in, I don't know how many pages of it, but it's identical. It's cut from that report and put into the technology report that went to Marshall. Arnold got his voice on the future from von Karman. And von Karman, by the way, and Van Bush never got along. There's a famous story about Bush and Karman. Karman and Bush were having a discussion, or Arnold and Bush were having a discussion about wind tunnels. And Van Bush asked Arnold, well, what do you think you should do to increase the technology for airframes? And Arnold said, well, I'm going to build a wind tunnel. And Bush said, oh, great. I got some people. Who do you have building it for you? And Arnold said, yeah, well, I already have Theodore von Karman to do it. So he undercut Van Bush and took him and built the first wind tunnels for the independent service. And so Karman couldn't stand Van Bush because Bush wanted to totally control military science. Karman wanted to train military people to be scientists. And they never saw eye to eye. The entire time that Karman was the head of the SAB and Bush was the presidential science advisor, they never got along. And Arnold capitalized on von Karman, and it's a good thing, because Karman was what the service needed. Arnold knew that, and Van Bush was left out in the cold, and they never recovered that relationship the whole time that they were around.
That's right.
Hi, Joe. It's good to see you, by the way, buddy. I haven't seen you in a while.
And I wanted to give a public recognition. I retired from the Air Force in 2000 and went got my PhD in history. And Dick was one of the people who encouraged me. Well, if you like space stuff and you like history stuff, why don't you go do your stuff? Go get a PhD in space history. And I did. So thanks, Dick.
Outstanding.
Well, guys, it's about 7:59. So I want to ask one final question of Dick and Robert before we wrap things up. And that's, when I read the book, I found the strategic perspective of Hapar on air power to be one that's enduring. That'd be one that should be embraced by Air Force today. And I'll quote it. Air power is not made up of airplanes alone. Air power is a composite of airplanes, air crews, maintenance crews, air bases, air supply, and sufficient replacements in both planes and crews to maintain a constant fighting strength, regardless of what happens, what bases, or what losses being inflicted by the enemy. Against this perspective, what do you think, have to think about today's Air Force, given his vision of air power, which to me seems one of the most encompassing definitions I've ever read in any Air Force doctrine at all. Robert, Dick?
Go ahead, Dick.
Well, what I think Hap Arnold would be completely mortified by how contracts are let in the services today. He would contend that the system by which technology is built, expanded upon, and finally put into service could never work. He used to do things with a handshake and a promise, and we all know that that is absolutely not possible today. It's happened a couple of times that I know of, but it on a regular basis, it's politics. How many states have to make parts for my B whatever bomber, and how many people have to approve this method of communication through whatever satellite? And it's a nightmare of communication and legalities that he would probably just retire and go grow grapes for wine.
You can't imagine the moment in Wichita, Kansas, when Boeing was dropping the ball in the B-29, and Hap Arnold flies out there, walks down the assembly line, writes on a chassis his name, and says, "I want this plane out that door by this date, or Boeing will never get another contract from the United States government." And they knew he could make that so. And, you know, can you imagine that today, where somebody walked into Lockheed and said, "Fix it or you're dead," you know, and they know that with a snap of his fingers, he could make that happen. People jumped, and Boeing jumped. So, I mean, that's the world he lived in, because he was in a hurry. He had a war to win and no time to screw around with.
Okay, Dick,
the other thing is that today we're building 100 total airplanes, where he was building thousands, hundreds of thousands of aircraft.
Right, right.
It's 8:02, it's past our witching hour. So I'd like to, first of all, Dick, what are your last thoughts about Hap Arnold that people should take away from his life and his career that stand out to you?
Well, I think after spending a large portion of my adult life with Hap Arnold, I appreciate him more and more the older I get. When I went into the Academy, Billy Mitchell was the father of the Air Force. I don't know if anybody remembers that. But it wasn't until maybe the 80s that Hap Arnold really climbed back up that food chain. And really that happened when General Fogelman and Dr. Widnall had the reins in the Pentagon and relit the flame and did the New World Vistas study. And there's an anniversary of that coming up in 2 days. On the 15th of December is the day in 1994 when that study was turned in to Widnall and Fogelman. And we're going to celebrate that on our website. You'll see a link to a video that we made on the staff when I was in the SAB that documents the production of the Scientific Advisory Board and New World Vistas to celebrate that whole thing. It goes all the way back to Carmen and all the way forward to Gene McCall. And I watched it the other day. And you could have done it 2 months ago. If you haven't ever seen it, or if you haven't ever read New World Vistas in part, you need to do it. These were visionaries who saw things that we have totally forgotten about. And it's time to rekindle that light of the phoenix. Get up out of the ashes. Bring this stuff back to life. And that's one of the things in the foundation that we are specifically trying to do. And we hope you enjoy our efforts to do that.
Robert, who's your grandfather? Last comment to you, sir.
Well, I come back to a comment. I had a really pleasant afternoon with Secretary of the Air Force Roche a number of years ago. We drank a fair amount of wine, talked a lot of history. And so I asked him finally, he was a history guy. And I asked him finally, I said, have we reached the boundaries of Hap Arnold's vision for air power and any of this? And Secretary Roche says, we're not even close to the boundary of that vision. So, and that's if all of this can, as Dick says, rekindle interest in all of the things that are eternal in this forward movement into air power, space power, and how it blends together and inspires people in the contemporary force, this is a good thing. There's lessons to be learned from this. This is not about hero worship. This is about learning from these things and moving on. And Hap Arnold would not want hero worship. He'd want to inspire people to move forward. And if all of this does that, so much the better.
Awesome.
It gives more credence to know the past, shape the future than ever before.
Right.
Well, Richard and Robert and Dick, thanks for this awesome session. That's the fastest I've ever had in my life. One of these sessions went by so fast because fast discussion about your grandfather. One of the, you know, again, we should, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, but you don't realize how big those giants really are to read books about them. That's our last session for the year on historical figures. I want to thank my team. I think I'm bringing them up on screen. Jen, Mel, and Mel, three active duty Air Force officers who actually make these sessions work. Without them, it would never happen. So, ladies, thank you. All are active duty and all are working at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, of all places, where they're based out of. So, we'll be back on next year looking at the Vietnam War. Dick and I work on the books right now and the authors. We'll probably have our first book session in February. But after that, since then, I like the foundation for supporting this book club, and we'll keep it going for as long as we can. But then Robert and Dick, thank you so much. Everybody, very Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year, and we'll see you next year.
Same to you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks again.
Well done, everybody. Enjoyed it.
Is that film out here?
Another great event.
Hey, Troy, was that Phil Mallinger?
I don't know.
I'm using his book for my paper, and I really wanted to talk to him. I think that was him.
Yeah, I didn't recognize him. I've met him before, but that did not look like Phil to me.
Okay. Well, I haven't read this book in like 10 years. It's been a hot minute, and I just got a copy of it 2 days ago, but I've been working on homework. There was no opportunity for me to do this. But how's everything going over there?
It's good. Do you want to FaceTime?
I'm going to go say night to Theo, and then I'll give Natalie a call. All right. See ya.
Recorded.